There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
No, you want to.
Keep up the good work, and there you have it.
There you go.
With the qualifying.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Steve Faub, my co-host. This is podcast number 1084, March 3rd, 2025, Stephen.
This F1 Weekly podcast is brought to you by Yahoo Ads. Yahoo Ads provide you, the F1Weekly.com web surfer, with ads that interest you. From tickets to the Canadian Grand Prix to ringtones for your cell phone, Yahoo Ads get you the stuff you really want. Click on them. You know you want to.
Thank you, Steve, and thank you, Yahoo Ads. On today's program, we've got Nasser in a great mood talking about his trip to Monza and all that surrounded it. And then our interview this week. Yes, we're going to start out with an early one, 2006, Laguna Seca. He runs into his friend Juan Manuel Fangio Jr., of course. His uncle was the real McCoy. So it's a great conversation, great interview. And this is one of the early ones that I am still there at the beginning, but then he realizes he is in charge of interviews, and we slowly get rid of me as the podcast moves along in time. But this is the beginning, and he always was very polite to include me at the beginning of the interview. Take a listen. Also, I do need to remind everybody, yes, we do need your contributions to keep this program up on the servers. Just click on the Support F1 Weekly tab. You know you want to. I want to thank Maron Abrahams. Thank you very, very much. Nasser, take it away.
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. And now, as we spin the globe and go around the world with Motorsports Mondial and the King, the guru, the solid tree standing in the desert, Nasser Hamid.
Oh, thank you so much, sir. Thank you. And hello again to everybody everywhere. In the headlines, this will be of interest to you, Clark, because we are old school. Fittipaldi and Piquet winning on both sides of the pond. Piquet and Stoffel win by the Danube. Christian Horner has a winning team in GP3 also. And my favorite ex-Caterham staff goes Jacoby and Myers. Have you heard anything about that?
Oh, yes. I mean, the staff went out bonkers, pointing fingers, blah, blah, blah. And I love people who get, let's put it this way, laid off, start legal proceedings. And so Caterham sent out some press releases. They're going to fight tooth and nail. So you know what this is called? Mm-hmm. The end of a Formula One team.
Yes, that's very true. Okay, let's start with some motorsport section, and we shall begin with Hoppe Doss, our favorite action in Budapest. First pole for cousin Felipe in the feature race, so I was very happy about that, and sharing the front row with him was your homeboy, Francais, Tom Dillman from Alsace, who is replacing Alexander Rossi at the Caterham GP2 team. Victory went to another French driver, Arthur Pig, brother of Charles. First GP2 win for the Campos GP2 team, and that would be the team owned by Mr. Adrian Campos, who was one of the earliest backer of Mr. Nando, as you may already know. There was a tremendous battle between, this was very, very good, between Felipe Nasser and championship leader Julian Palmer. Worth watching on YouTube in case some people have not seen this. Palmer finished fourth and Nasser was ninth. Belgian Stoffel Vandoorne, who is, like Kevin Magnussen, part of the McLaren Young Driver Program, was the winner of the sprint race on Sunday, and he won the season opener also. He is now third in the championship with 107 points. A rookie third in GP2 is very rare, so things are looking very good for him. Julian Palmer was second and Felipe Nasr third. The two had some issues in exchange of words after the race. Palmer leads the championship over the Brazilian driver, 188 to 145. Now we go to Hape Tres, GP3. On Saturday, the event was won by Richie Stanaway of New Zealand, who is a tremendous racing talent. This kid was on his way to Formula One after winning the German F3 in a dominating fashion, but then suffered a serious back injury in a World Series by Renault race a few years ago, and then he was on the sideline for many months. His status teammate Nick Yololi from UK was second, and Romanian Robert Vizoyu was third. How many times do you hear drivers from Romania on a podium?
Not very often.
I do miss Robert Kubica anytime I hear a Slavonic name, I have to say.
We all miss Robert.
Yeah, tremendous talent. Second race of the weekend was won by Patrick Niederhauser of Arden International, and that team is, of course, owned by Christian Horner. And you know, Clark, a couple of days ago, I was just going through YouTube, and if somebody is interested, they can do that also. And I just picked up a season review. I think it was like 1997 or something like that of the Formula 3000 series, you know, which was replaced by GP2. And in that season, Christian Horner is a race car driver. And it's like a two-hour program. Very nice. Monty is there. Ricardo Zonta is there. So if anybody wants to check it out, it's a good recap. Okay, back to GP3. English chap Alex Lynn was fourth in both races. He is in the Red Bull program and leads the championship over Stanaway, 134 to 103 points. Now we come to some famous Brazilian names. Pietro Fittipaldi, grandson of Emo, won two Formula Renault races at Brands Hatch, while another famous name, Pedro Piquet, won the F3 race at Curitiba in Brazil. And Curitiba, or as the natives call it, Curitiba, is the hometown of our favorite XF1 racer, Mr. Ricardo Zonta. And playing the name game, Harry Newey. Have you heard of a racing driver, Harry Newey?
No, I like the name, though.
Yeah. He turned 16 on July 25th and celebrated his naissance by testing a Formula 4 car at Brands Hatch. He may switch to single-seaters from karting next season. Papito is working in Milton Keynes, which is also the European headquarters for F1 Weekly, for an Austrian-owned Formula Uno team. And just to make it simple, he is the son of Adrian Newey. So do you think he's going to have problem finding a sponsor to race in Formula Renault or GP3?
I suspect some drinking sponsor of some sort.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, Ferrari engine man Luca Marmorini has been rumored that he's leaving Ferrari, but now it's been officially confirmed that he has left the building in Maranello. Previously, he worked for Toyota Formula One team and was kind enough to show me a brand new Toyota F1 engine in team's garage at Monza some years ago. That was very nice and cool of him. And I also ran into him and had a brief chat with him at the Jerez Airport last January. And who knows, man, if the stars aligned again, maybe I might make another run to Jerez for the preseason testing. Time will tell.
You and Tio Pepe.
Tio Pepe and Dr. Miguel, Dr. Farrington, Mr. Brazier, any of the family members are welcome.
Excellent.
And we'll keep people posted what's happening. Okay, we talked about this HR trouble at Caterham. I have a feeling, you know, you mentioned team is fighting back. I think the team's legal counterattack will be like their performance on the track. Pointless. What do you think?
I think that's a good idea. But just think of all the Jacobian Myers fans.
Oh, yeah. They will make a lot of money. That's for sure.
Yeah.
And Spa 24 Hour, you know, very famous race. Winners were Rene Rast, Lawrence Venture, and Marcus Winkelhock. But there were some big and serious crashes during the event, and I hope, you know, everybody gets back to good health soon. Indy cars in Toronto, Sebastian Bourdais wins race one of the weekend, and Mike Conway was the winner in the second race. Clark, it's amazing, you know, you talk about Boulevard of Broken Dreams of Formula One. Sebastian Bourdais at one time, you know, had a chance to go, and I heard a rumor that he did not get the Renault drive, or at least did not get into the Renault driver development program, because he refused to become a client of Flavio Briatore. which is, you know, used to be a requirement in those days. And Mike Conway won the British F3 in a very impressive fashion against good competition. And I thought he was on his way to Formula One, but now he's in IndyCar racing. And after a serious accident at Indy, he does not do oval races. So good for him, you know.
Good for him, yeah. Yeah. Who needs it?
Yeah. Oh, thanks a lot. The Kyalami circuit in South Africa has been bought out by Porsche. This is a great racing track with a lot of history. I love the track, how it comes down after the start of the race. Both Mario Andretti and Carlos Reutemann won their first Grand Prix races at this track. And Michael Andretti made his F1 debut here in 1993. And his only problem that season was his teammate. And you know who his teammate was.
Ed Machismo.
Yeah, with the yellow helmet. Mm. And in 1974, Peter Revson was killed in a testing accident in a shadow. Day I remember very well. A few years later, there was that horrible crash involving Tom Price, also in a shadow, and which also killed him and a track marshal. Very, very sad day. Jeff Gordon, the Rainbow Warrior, won the Brickyard 400, so that's good for him.
That was pretty exciting. He won the inaugural Brickyard 400, and does it again, what, 20 years later?
Yeah, I think this was his fifth win at the Brickyard.
Yes, he does very well at the Brickyard, and I was happy for him and his beautiful Belgian wife.
Oh, yes. Very easy on the eyes.
And here's your F1Weekly.com Formula One trivia. Ligier raced from 1976 to 1997 and was created by Guy or Guy Ligier, former racer and rugby player. Which of the following pilots was not a Ligier driver? Jacques Lafitte, Andrea De Cesaris, Olivier Panis, Aguri Suzuki, or Derek Warwick? I'll have the answer toward the end of the podcast.
Our historical correspondent, Nasser Hamid, is back from his European trek and his attendance at Monza. He was there when the Tifosi screamed as Fernando Alonso's car came to a screaming halt. So I want to introduce Hamid. Nasser, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Trying very hard to still recover from my jet lag.
Yes. A little jet lag is definitely part of the program, but here at F1 Weekly, we go all the way when we need to find the information to help our listeners understand what's going on in the F1 world. So there you were at Monza, and also you have some other countries that you attended in terms of racing, some reports. Talk to us what is going on in the racing industry. Let's give us a quick glimpse in Motorsports Mondial attended by Nasser.
Well, this whole trip was triggered by an invitation of all the people by one of our listeners, Mr. Mohammed Manzoor in England. He invited me to come and see his son, Kazim Manzoor, see him race in the European Go-Kart Championship in a town called Marienburg, Belgium, which is near a town called Charleroi. And I believe you have been there.
Yes, Charleroi, nice town. Obviously, north of France, I always drive through there on my way to Paris.
Yeah. So I want to thank Mr. Manzoor for inviting me and his family for being so nice to me. It was great to see this kid race, real talent. And we'll talk more on this Belgium episode later on. So that was the trigger that I said, okay, if he's racing on September 3rd, a week later is the Gran Premio d'Italia at my all-time favorite track, Autodromo di Monza. So I should put two and two together and say, that's a trip to Europe. And then what I did is I was looking for many ways whether I should. I knew I was going to the race in Belgium. I was going to the race in Italy. And then I said, okay, where do I spend 3-4 days in between the week? And I had a chance to go to Paris or England. Or I finally decided for a couple of reasons. One of the main was that I have a distributor in Germany near Cologne, so I figured I can use this as an excuse to go and meet him for our, you know, beautiful Motorsport Memories Dynamic Duels 2007 calendar. So I flew into Frankfurt. I also met there one of our listeners, a young lady by the name of Heike Hallenberger, and she has a pretty nice website, www.motorsport-life.de for Deutschland. So it was nice meeting her, and we did an interview with her also about her interests. And not surprisingly, she likes Michael Schumacher. She thinks he's the coolest. To each his own, or her own. And, you know, she goes to a lot of races. So it's very interesting to see different people, you know, and hear their perspective, how they attend races, you know, what triggered their interests. So that was also part of the thing. And what I did on the way back from Belgium, I stopped again in Frankfurt. And this was a very great moment for me. I'm sure most of our listeners, and you, I know for a fact, know Rainer Schlegelmilch, one of the most famous photographers. I've been enjoying his work in magazines and periodicals and books for 30-plus years. And I was able to actually go to his house and sit down with him and have a 3 or 4 hour conversation, and also did an interview with him, which would be on one of our separate episodes. It was very nice to hear from him, you know, how racing has changed, not just from a technical, technological point of view, but, you know, personalities and the people. And he gave me his feedback on how, you know, it's like, for example, being German, he knew Michael Schumacher, as, you know, before he got into Formula One. And like he said, now he's on a mountain so high, out of reach for me. And he said there was a time when he first came into Formula One that both of them would be sitting in an airport lounge waiting for flights, you know, and you could talk to him. And now you probably cannot even talk to Michael Schumacher's peon. And then, so I drove down, I went to Nürburgring. And let me just tell you something. And I'm sure if any of our listeners have gone there, they will probably agree with me. And if they have not, I would highly, highly recommend taking a road trip to Nürburgring. And there is a gentleman in England, Ben Lovejoy. He has a website which gives all the details about how to plan a trip there, where to stay. Clark, I have never taken a road trip as beautiful, as gorgeous as going to Nürburgring. It is just absolutely beautiful. And I'm very, very impressed with Deutschland. And I understand why they say now Deutschland über alles. It is a gorgeous place. The whole country was beautiful. And the trip there is amazing. It's near a small town called Adenau. And the interesting thing was, you know, I'm not the best in geographical directions, you know. I'm geographically challenged. So, obviously, I'm not familiar with the road system and highways. So I made a few wrong turns, and I had to stop and ask for directions. At Nürburgring, my distributor was with me. We went to, there's a portion, first of all, we walked on the old, what they call the South Schleife, you know, Zugschleife. And it is an absolutely incredible feeling to walk 10, 15 minutes on these small roads, lush green, and they would, you know, it's pretty steep up and down, right, turning all the time, that they would race cars and motorcycles. And he told me on this part, I think the last event was a motorcycle race in the 70s, probably early 70s. And it's just an incredible feeling walking through that forest, you know, Eiffel Mountains area. Incredible. Then he took me to an area called Adenau Bridge, I believe it is called. Just an incredible turns and cars going up. And you can take your car there, any car. Mm-hmm. So I saw some guy with Swedish plates in his Corvette running around, people with Fiat Puntos running around, Porsche Carreras. And they also have these, what they call rent taxis. You can rent, you know, to go a few laps or as many laps as you want to. So pretty incredible place. And then we also went to a portion of the old track called Brunchen, which is again typical, you know, like a spa or the old Nürburgring, up and down, constantly turning. It's a great facility. And then I also made a quick trip to see Hockenheimring, which is another amazing facility. Just a lot of history. You know, they have all these trees lined up there. And, you know, I stood there in the empty grandstand looking at those trees for 15, 20 minutes. And I kept thinking of two things, you know. One was Jim Clark, how he must have gone down for the last time in 1968. And the other thing I kept thinking was Ayrton Senna and Alain Prost battling. I believe it was the 1989 or 1990 German Grand Prix where Senna was like, this is one of my favorite Senna events, where he was just ahead of Prost, and Prost had a faster car. And, you know, this was the old Hockenheim when there was no these Mickey Mouse chicanes. And he just would not let him, pass him. So, and then in the end, Prost hit the cones and was disqualified. So it's they also have a museum there. And they have the first Jordan that Michael Schumacher drove, you know, 7-Up, and beautiful car. Now, I'm not sure if it's the exact car or a replica. It has, his name is there. But, you know, and you're going to love this. The car is parked, and right across the car is a red car with signage saying Budweiser. And the name on the car is Jeff Burdine. And most of the inscriptions there are in German, but I could figure out that it said that this car was used in Days of Thunder. So I was standing there looking at the 7-Up Jordan and then looking at the Budweiser NASCAR. And I was thinking of you, Clark, and how much you love N-Series.
Thank you very much, Nasser. I appreciate your thoughts and your sentiment.
My pleasure. And you got to go and check out this museum. They have a lot of old cars, of course. They have a huge selection of motorbikes, you know, NSUs and Java from Czechoslovakia and the early Hondas and Yamahas. It's a pretty good museum. It's small in size, though. But again, the place is beautiful, and it's like kind of reminded me of Imola. And like Indy also, you know, you walk out of the track, you're in a residential area. And so it's just pretty neat to see, you know, such a big facility that we watch on TV at 5 in the morning right there in a neighborhood. And then I went to Italy, but the last thing I did in Germany was I went to spend a couple of days in Munich, went to a museum there. Unfortunately, the BMW museum was closed, and they have the first car that won the World Championship with the turbo engine, 1983, Nelson Piquet. I wanted to see that car, and I could not, but there'll be other trips, hopefully, sponsored by F1 Weekly, hopefully. And I went to Stuttgart to see the Mercedes Museum, another extremely impressive facility. I was a little short on time, so I kind of rushed through it, but I did go to the spot where I really wanted to go, where they had the racing cars, and they, I'm glad they were not involved in stock car racing, so there's no Budweiser or Miller Lite, you know, S-Class or M-Class Mercedes there, but they do have some of their trucks. You know, the truck racing is pretty popular, the big trucks.
Oh, yes, the semi-trucks. Yeah. Yes, that's actually quite big in Europe and actually very fun to watch.
Yeah, and they have a big like a section that looks like a long piece of a road, and they have these trucks and their Group C cars, sports cars, Formula One cars. Mika Hakkinen's car is there. And for me, you know, being from the old school and old country and old world, I was very interested in seeing those cars from the 30s, 40s, 50s. They had the car that won the Tripoli Grand Prix, which, you know, amazing thing to see. They had the car that won the 1955 Mille Miglia, number 722, Stirling Moss and Dennis Jenkinson. I mean, this is part of history I grew up with, at least reading, you know, and just to go there and stand there and look at these things, incredible. And Stuttgart was a very, very beautiful city, absolutely gorgeous. And then I went to Italy, which is a different world than Germany. And if anybody is traveling to Monza, I have a little travel advisory. If you take the train to Monza and you think you are close to the track, be ready for a long, long walk. You know, I had enough time on Saturday. I took the train, went to Monza station, and they told me that the bus will take you to the track. Okay, so I'm all excited that I know the track is in a park, and from my previous visit in 1982 and 2001, I know there's a lot of walk. But I figured being a major international event and thousands of people coming there, that the bus will take you at least very close to the action. So I got to the track at least 1 hour before qualifying, which I really wanted to see, you know, because now they don't have just one car running as they used to some years ago. But man, there was a walk for at least 45, 50 minutes. And nothing is worse than when you can see these cars going on qualifying runs, and you can't see the cars. Again, it's lush green, tall trees. And I got up to Parabolica, could not see anything, and my seat was where the first chicane is. And I just, with all these people, just took a long time to get there. And as luck would have it, the qualifying was over. So I missed all the schmazel, what happened with Masso and Alonso, which I think it was a lot of nonsense, basically.
FIA nonsense.
Yeah, yeah, it's pathetic. But now they're trying to make changes, too, so these things don't happen.
Yeah, but it's a little late.
Yeah, better late than never.
Exactly. Thank you, Mr. Budweiser.
Yeah, and Mr. Budweiser?
Yeah, thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome. And as far as the race is concerned, yeah, the interesting thing about the race was, first thing I noticed is that they were surprisingly, you know, with Schumacher going on and the car being very competitive, I thought it would be like a jam-packed situation. I was in this grandstand by the first chicane, quite a few empty seats. Not as many empty seats at Indy, unfortunately, but quite a few. It's like, it was not like sold out, definitely not.
Yeah, and what kind of prices were we talking about for the seats?
Oh, you're hurting my feelings now.
No, because I anticipate probably $300 for a fairly inexpensive
seat.
Yeah,
I just changed the currency.
Yeah.
Euros, 300 euros. What happened is that I knew it was going to be at least 150 or 200. Prices a little bit expensive in Europe than here. And what I got was a three-day pass, and I don't know why they charged me. Actually, I bought it from a travel agency or some agency that deals with this thing in Milan. It was a three-day pass, and which was like, I think, 30, 40 euros for Friday and, you know, a little bit for Saturday, and main damage was for Sunday. But I'll tell you something, the seating I had was incredible. It was up high, and you could see the cars coming on the main straight and see the turns and the blast. What really paid for the ticket was the blast from that first corner. These cars are just incredible, the way they sound. And I don't know why, the Super Aguris had the most high pitch and most different sound. You could tell this was a different car. But, you know, even with impressive sound, they were back of the bus operation, as always. So it was a lot of fun. And the other thing I noticed is that the Tifosis were very quiet as long as Kimi Raikkonen was leading. And when Schumacher took over after the first pit stop, obviously they were very happy. Everybody, you know, most people had red hats and red caps and, you know, a few finished flags and few. Somebody was running around with which I think was a Venezuelan flag, not a Colombian flag, because they're very similar, because they have a guy in GP2, Ernesto Visa. When Alonso moved up to third place, let me tell you, a lot of fingers were flying as when his car would come around, because they were not happy. That would have meant only a four-point difference in the championship. But the Tifosis were really thrilled when he dropped out. And he dropped out right where I was standing. And the car came and just, and he parked the car right where I was. And he just walked out and, you know, walked away. But everybody was excited. I remember this was like many years ago. Senna was leading at Monza. And Prost was second. And his car blew up. The engine blew up by a few laps to go. And they were just like, and both were driving McLaren.
Yeah.
And they were just like totally thrilled because Prost had signed for Ferrari the following year. Do you remember that race?
Mm-hmm.
There was a similar type of situation.
Fantastic.
Yeah, and I did the usual what I do when I go to a racetrack. I walked most of the track after the race in the opposite direction, you know, walking through Parabolica with all the history there and what has happened there, both in good terms and bad terms, triumphs and tragedies. You know, a lot of races have been won breaking into Parabolica or blasting out of Parabolica. And, you know, Jochen Rindt was killed there. And Von Trips had his big accident, fatal accident there. And then the interesting thing about that track, obviously it's sold and they've done a lot of, you know, improvement to facilities. But you can still see the age shows. But the, you know where the Lesmo curves are?
Mm.
After the Lesmo curves, the cars come down to Curva Ascari. And then they go towards Parabolica. That area, Clark, you will not believe, it's so narrow. First of all, the track is also, the whole track is narrow. But there is hardly any runoff area. I actually tried to measure the runoff area, and I kid you not, I could not even take two steps from the end of the track to the, you know,
the barrier.
The barrier, exactly. And there's not a whole lot they can do because they have these trees and embankment. But it's very, very, you know, narrow track, hardly any runoff area. And you know, now they have some safety concern, but they are from a different part of the track. So very interesting, you know, to go there and check the scene out. I was there in 1982, which was the first time I went to a Formula One race. That day, Renault won. Ferrari was second and third, with Tom Bay and Mario Andretti. But this time, Lady Luck was not on their side.
That's okay. The Tifosi, I think, especially with Michael Schumacher retiring, certainly deserved the win that Michael got. It was earned. I think Renault definitely got caught up in the hype with the FIA, the rulings. And I think if Fernando Alonso had managed his engine a little bit better, because the emotions really, really, really were running high, might have been able to finish the race. He admitted he overran the engine, and certainly a fairly dependable motor, first time this year.
Yeah, first time in 3 years from what I've heard.
Exactly.
And hate to burst your bubble, but I think he's not going to win the championship if both cars finish. The Ferrari has the pace, and you know, Michael Schumacher may be German, but he ain't no Nick Heidfeld, you know. When the heat is on, he will take the fight to to Alonso, and Alonso can do the same thing, but I just think the advantage right now as a package is has been with Michael Schumacher and Ferrari for the last few years.
I think it's been the advantage to Michael Schumacher since the United States Grand Prix.
Absolutely.
But the next three races, I think the advantage goes back to Renault. And even though they've had some problems, I think they're going to make it up. They have some really, really good engineers. Fernando Alonso, this three-week period will give him a time to calm down. He is a very good attacker and can handle Michael Schumacher, as he's shown in 2005. So I think it's still up in the air. I'm not going to make any predictions, ladies and gentlemen, but Renault is still a formidable team.
Absolutely, and no question about it. And I think if cars are equal, then I would give benefit again to Alonso. You know, he's young, more hungry probably, and he has shown that he can perform very well under pressure. And same cannot be said about Michael Schumacher, despite his 5,000 wins and 9,000 pole position. You know what I'm saying?
He does
crack under pressure.
Schumacher has made some mistakes. Hungary, yeah. For instance,
yeah.
Where literally, I think the team as a whole made mistakes without, with no communications to Michael Schumacher to calm him down and tell him, you know, you might want to come in, change tires, and still finish in the points. Mm-hmm. That was a big mistake, not only by Michael, but by the team. And I think we have mistakes to be seen in the upcoming three races by both teams. And the deciding factor, once again, could be Michelin and Bridgestone. I think Michelin's done a fine job. McLaren is doing well on the Michelins. BMW is doing well on the Michelins. Renault is doing well on the Michelins. We'll see what happens, but I give credit to Ferrari for doing a fantastic job.
Yeah. And another thing that will go against Alonso, keeping in mind that advantage is with Ferrari right now, is that Alonso cannot expect Fisichella to go and pass Schumacher. That's not going to happen. He'll be lucky if he passes Massa.
Hi, I'm Giancarlo Fisichella, and you are listening F1 Weekly.
If Massa finishes between Schumacher and Alonso, I just have a hunch that Raikkonen probably will somewhere get in between the sandwich too, and that will just screw up either Schumacher or Alonso's a bit for the championship. But, you know, these are just prediction. I mean, Ferrari can have two DNF.
And not only that, but Ferrari could still have a DNF.
Yeah, sure.
And let's not forget the B factor, which is BMW, coming up the grid. Kubica, podium, fantastic. They're doing well. Nick Heidfeld's doing well. They could split this all apart with McLaren, BMW, Ferrari, and Renault in the top four. And Honda making some strides, but always seem to falling back. We have three great races coming up, and this championship is going to end with a bang.
Well, I'm going to make a couple of predictions, okay? One of my predictions was that I could not see Schumacher and Raikkonen become teammates, because you never good drivers never want a good driver. Michael Schumacher being at the tail end of his career, it would not have been a fair comparison anyway, but he knew what was coming. He cannot handle, you know, Raikkonen. Raikkonen is just a very quick driver. And the other two predictions I will make, one is about Kubica, the other is about Massa. there was a pretty big Polish contingent at Monza, and they were just like shouting, Kubica, Kubica, which was good to see, you know. And the guy did a tremendous job. He really, you know, held off Massa. And I think this guy has got two predictions I will make is that what I call the dishes are done for Nick Heidfeld, okay? You know, he thought he was German in the home team, blah, blah, blah. And Kubica has pretty much rained on his Oktoberfest parade. The other prediction I will make is that, and I've seen this, I'm no expert on motor racing, but I've seen it way too many times, that Felipe Massa's career is over. When I say career is over in the sense that Raikkonen is going to put such a big difference between him, you know, between the two, that he will be exposed that, you know, this guy's, I mean, it's, what's going to happen, it will be like worse than Schumacher and Barrichello. And when somebody really, if you, you know, the name of the game in this business or any business is winning, you know, if he cannot take the fight to Raikkonen, which I'm convinced he will not, if he could not take it to Schumacher, he definitely will not take it to a guy who's 10 years younger. Nobody's going to want him as a number one driver. And the other interesting things now are these young guns. Nico Rosberg. Nico Rosberg has got a fight on his hand now. Most probably, Hamilton or Gary Paffett will get the drive for McLaren. I have a hunch Hamilton will get the drive because McLaren has invested a lot of time and energy into this guy. And Heikki Kovalainen. It'll be interesting to see who wins the race among these three.
Absolutely.
So there's a lot of competition. And, you know, all these people like Jarno Trulli, Ralf Schumacher, Giancarlo Fisichella, and hate to say even Scott Speed, they really have a very hard time now moving forward in the next 2 years. It's not saying that they're not going to do a good job, but there is so much talent coming up, Nelsinho Piquet in another year or two, that it's just going to be extremely hard for them.
Yeah, and it doesn't stop. The young guns that are coming up into Formula One, for example, Sebastian Vettel,
there you go.
19-year-old from Germany, doing a fantastic job. Obviously, Red Bull owns him, lending him to BMW, but just supreme driving. And like you said, Nasser, we have got some great young talent. I think we're going to see a lot of retiring in the next year or so.
Yeah, I mean, those who do not want to retire, racing will retire them because of the talent pool that's coming.
I absolutely agree. Nasser, keep up the good work. A fantastic trip. We love this reporting. We'll have some of these fantastic interviews that you got in your beautiful European trek for F1Weekly.com, including the likes of Mike Wilson. I mean, this guy competed against Ayrton Senna.
He beat Ayrton Senna.
He beat Ayrton Senna.
Yeah. And you know what is interesting is all these people were in Marienburg, Belgium. I interviewed Mike Wilson. And again, you know, I've always been interested as a non-technical person on the human side of the business to ask him and hear his experiences with Senna on and off the track, what he thought of him. And there's a very interesting thing that he said that, you know, he had won the 6th World Championship in go-karting. And there's a big Italian newspaper, Gazzetto dello Sport, and they just had a one-liner that, you know, Mike Wilson wins 6 World Championships. And Ayrton Senna, who was reigning world champion basically at that time in Formula One, he called that a newspaper. He says, what are you doing? This guy won 6 world championships and you're giving him one line. So the newspaper called the guy, Mike Wilson, that, hey, Ayrton Senna called. Can you come and do an interview? And these things you don't hear, you know, in newspapers or Speed TV and all that. So that was very interesting. I also was able to interview Martin Hines, who's a very interesting character, and he ran Mike Wilson. And Mike Wilson, in turn, ran Fernando Alonso. So there's a lot of history with these people in terms of world championship material. And the guy, Dino Chiesa, who's running this, Kazim Manzoul, he has run Nico Rosberg, Robert Kubica, Lewis Hamilton, and a lot of inside information, you know, what it takes to become a racing driver. And they all say the same thing, you know, it's sure speed and talent is important, but the most important element is you have to have the desire to win and the commitment to the program. It'll be interesting for our listeners to listen to what Mike Wilson has to say about Fernando Alonso. Fernando Alonso raced with him from the age of 12 to 19. And just to hear what he has to say about this kid, I mean, you know, when you're 12, 13, you're just a little punk, you know. That, I mean, he's talking about him like, I mean, people who have seen Fernando Alonso before he got into car racing, forget Formula One, they talk about his commitment to racing like people talk about Michael Schumacher's commitment with Ferrari. But that's what it takes to get to where these people are.
This is fantastic, and I'm sure our listeners are going to appreciate these interviews because they go to the inner bowels of Formula One, how people get to Formula One with people like Fernando, Nico, Kubica. I mean, this is just great stuff. Thank you, Nasser, for bringing us to the edge of the beginning. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, sir.
We'll be back in 60 seconds.
How far is the moon from the Earth?
Interested in trivia? Please tune in to My Trivia Podcast, a weekly podcast rarely more than 8 minutes in duration, with 10 or more questions and answers of fun facts about topics such as science, geography, history, and there's even some audio thrown in. You can find My Trivia Podcast in iTunes, Podcast Alley, and other podcast sites, or you can go to www.mytriviapodcast.com. Hope to have you tuning in.
The moon is a quarter of a million miles away. The capital...
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. Now I'd like to introduce an interview that we did with the great and wonderful Juan Manuel Fangio II, the nephew of the great one, the Formula One driver of the 50s. You can't have anything better to talk about when it comes to racing than Juan Manuel Fangio II. This man has done it. And interestingly enough, our wonderful historical correspondent Nasser Hamid has had some dealings with Juan Manuel Fangio II. Nasser, how do you know this gentleman?
Well, of course, from racing, first of all. You know, I knew of his career when he was racing a little bit in Argentina, and as a young person, he went to Europe. And then when he came here to the United States, you know, I came here in 85, and it was around the same time he started racing here. He was in the Corvette Challenge, which used to be a pretty popular series at one time. But when I really got to know him personally and also met his beautiful wife, Viviana, was when he joined Dan Gurney's All-American Racers with the Toyota program. Dan was running the GTO program with Willie T. Ribbs, whom I've known for a long time, and also Chris Gord and Dennis Haase. But when they moved up to GTP, Dennis Haase, who was a longtime employee with Dan Gurney and Chris Gord, that was just too much for them, and he was brought into the team. And very nice. I remember the joke around the team was that, you know, you have to ask him the same question like five times because his English was not very good. And he was a young man and in a hurry and did very well, won the championship with Dan Gurney in the GTP thing. And it was always very nice to talk to him about racing, and his uncle was still alive at that time. And I remember at one event, his uncle, Juan Manuel Fangio, the legend from Argentina, was here at Laguna Seca. Unfortunately, I did not get a chance to meet the man, but through the second nephew, I was able to get an autographed picture of, you know, the main man, which I still have and cherish very much. And then, you know, when the Toyota program was winding down the GTP and they were moving in, they moved into Indy cars, Champ cars. And obviously, it was a troublesome program. They designed their own car. And at that time, he bailed out and moved back to Argentina. And, you know, he was surprised to find out I followed his career even then. He was racing in a sedan series there. And now doesn't have a lot of involvement in racing, but takes care of his family business, and like his uncle, lives in the town called Balcars, which is about 200 kilometers, I believe, from Buenos Aires. You know, he invited us to come and visit him in Argentina.
Exactly, we've been invited.
And, you know, he gave us his home phone number, and we have to, you know, go there and talk to him.
We'll go there next year, Nas.
That's what my agenda is, and I, like I told him, and he was there when I mentioned that, if he can get me, it will be, I'll tell you, for me, one of the most fascinating moments of my life, if I can go to the Juan Manuel Fangio Museum, which is also in Balcars, Argentina, with him, And that'll be very, very nice.
And maybe Carlos Reutemann could join us.
Carlos Reutemann lives in another town, Santa Fe, which is another few hundred kilometers from him. But, you know, of course, both being Argentinians and fairly famous, they know each other. And remember, he was talking about in this interview how he drove Carlos Reutemann's Brabham, mm-hmm. because Carlos had some prior commitments, political commitments, I guess. But I'll tell you, if Juan Manuel Fangio II can get me a audience with Carlos Reutemann, who was one of my early favorites, heroes, I always liked him, I would go in a heartbeat to Buenos Aires, Balcarce, or wherever these people might be. It's just it was very nice to talk to him. And, you know, we did a photo shoot, if you may say, of him in front of a painting of his uncle, and there's a lot of resemblance, you know, racing is in the blood, and it was very nice to see him after so many years.
Very good. So stay tuned for the interview with Juan Manuel Fangio II.
This is my friend Clark Rogers.
How are you? How are you? Good.
And I know him from his days with Willie T and GTP Racing.
Oh, yeah.
We had a lot of good times.
Oh, wild.
You know,
wild.
We do a F1 Weekly podcast, and can we ask you a few questions, please?
Good,
you
sure.
Give a few minutes.
Okay, let's go. F1Weekly.com with Juan Manuel Fangio II.
Juan, welcome to F1 Weekly. And before you raced in America, tell us about your racing career in Europe, please.
Well, actually, I went to Europe, I think it was in 83. I was racing Formula 3 that year. Then I was racing Formula 3000 in 85. And I was, at the time, doing a few races also in America. So at the end of 85, I test Formula One, and but America was my choice. So at the end of 85, I came to America, and then I did the rest of my racing career here.
Which team did you test with in Formula One?
I drove the Osella, and I have a very good chance to drive for the next year. But it was not a big team, so I decided to do Formula 3000 because I thought that I had better opportunities to do good.
And among the tracks you raced in Europe, your favorite track?
Spa-Francorchamps.
Everybody says that. Good answer. Yeah. Okay, you know, you came to America and you raced here in the Corvette series also, if I remember correctly. In the Corvette Cup or whatever it was called, the Corvette Challenge?
Yeah, the Corvette, yes, yes. I did race the Corvette Challenge in 88. Yes, exactly right.
And then your uncle, Juan Manuel Fangio, biggest legend in the history of motor racing, his career was coming to an end when Dan Gurney's career was starting. You're right?
Yes.
How did you hook up with Dan Gurney? Because you had a very tremendous, successful career with him.
Well, when I was racing actually in Europe, Formula 3, I came to America with Cesare Garibaldi, who was the team owner, and to do Can-Am. In one of the trips, we came to see Dan Gurney. My team owner introduced me to Dan and said, well, he's one, we are maybe coming to the state, and we would like to have the chance to drive one of your car. And I remember, you know, Dan, how he is. And he smiled and say, what about if I want to keep him? And we smile, and he was always extremely special. And so that was the time when I met Dan for the very first time. And also, in the Miami races with the Mazdas, I was, all the cars were the same, and Willie T was racing one of the cars, and I was racing the other one, was fighting for, I think it was the second position, something like that. Dan was watching the race, so that was also my racing introduction to Dan Gurney.
Was that the race with identical Mazda RX-7s?
Right, exactly. I did that race 3 years. I did third in one race, and I won the next two.
And Willie T won one of the races. I remember he made a big pass on Michael Andretti. of which he's very proud of.
Willy won the first race, exactly right, and Michael did second, I did third.
Yeah.
With the following year, I came back, I won the race, and the next year I won again. So that was a good help for my career here in America.
And Dan Gurney is just not just a great team owner, but a great, very nice person. Your thoughts on Dan as a person?
Dan is, I say that to be able to know Dan Gurney is a privilege. I think is somebody extremely special in every sense. Somebody with a huge heart in every sense. As a human being, and also as a fighter. He's a guy that very easygoing, but very strong in their desires. So he will really go for things that he really want to achieve. And that was, it was especially to be next to him during all these years.
Now, you won a lot of races in GDP. What race, what victory stands out as the most important or the most memorable that you can say, hey, you know, I'm really proud of this win?
The race that, there are several races that, San Antonio, for example, is a race that we have problems with the gearbox and we couldn't qualify and we were ready to go to the grid and the gearbox stuck. And I was sitting in the car. Everybody else were going to the grid and my guys were changing the gearbox. Dan was standing in front of the car telling me every minute, every 2 minutes that everything was cool, that everything was going fine. I was with my helmet. So finally, in about 15 minutes, they took the gearbox away, they put it back, and they pushed the car into the grid. But of course, everybody was gone. They were on the parade laps. I was not able to go inside the racetrack, but when the race started, I was just making it to the end of the pit. So I was able to start the race behind the group, because the yellow flags and everything, I was able to keep contact with the leaders. Finally, the last part of the race, I was able to take the lead of the race and win the race.
Very impressive.
So, and that was something extremely special, something I always remember.
Did Dan say anything about the win after the race?
Well, nobody believed it. Because of course, I remember the gearbox, it was made to use 5 gears. So everything was related to use 5 gears. And during the race, I say, I'm losing time here shifting that much. So in places I was using first, I had to use second. In places where I was using second, I had to use third. So I was shifting much less and I was able to go much better. And especially when the racetrack was getting rougher. Finally, it was close to the end of the race. And I say, well, that's it. I'm running fifth. I cannot catch the leaders. And it was a big, huge accident. Huge. Car crash in the back of the straightaway. Big fire. So we pack up all together again, and when they restart the race, I was able to go fourth. Next lap, I ran third. After 2-3 laps, I went by, I was second, and at about 3 laps to the end, I was able to catch the lead and win the race. And I always remember then giving me peace when I was in the car, because I was sitting and I was looking at him, and he was with his patient telling me everything is okay, we'll be fine.
Your favorite track in America?
Road America.
I expected that.
Road America, and yeah, and then of course I like Mid Ohio, Laguna Seca.
How about Road Atlanta, which is a pretty nice track too.
It is nice, but I didn't have success in Road Atlanta, so that why. No, I like it. I like it because it's very challenging, but I race only once or twice in Road Atlanta.
Now I have some questions about your country, Argentina. Your uncle came from Balcarce. Is that where you live also now?
Yes, I live at about 30 kilometers from Balcarce.
And how far is Balcarce from Buenos Aires?
400 kilometers.
400 kilometers, very good. And are we going to see the Grand Prix of Argentina back? When I started following Formula One, 1973, that used to open the season, Argentina, then Brazil. Are we going to see Formula Uno back in Buenos Aires?
I don't think so. I would love to, but I don't think so because right now Formula One is running where the market is.
Yeah.
And
money market.
Money market. But I understand. It's okay. So at the time, South America with Brazil and Argentina was a very good market. But right now, the market is going into Asia a little bit more. And so I definitely don't think that we will have the chance to have Formula One again.
Now, when you left America, went back to Argentina, I remember seeing your names in South American sedan racing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah, so I was following your career even when you left this country. Are you still involved in racing as a driver?
No, it was only 1 year. It was the cool-off year. So I came back, I drove for the Peugeot factory.
Yeah, I remember that.
And 1 year, well, it was fun. And then at the end of the year, I retired completely from motor racing.
So yes. Do you have any involvement in Argentine motorsport as a consultant or in any shape or form?
I'm involved with a factory in Argentina, but nothing about racing. It's just appearances. And when they do introductions of new cars and things like that.
Señor Carlos Alberto Reutemann, also known as Lole, was one of my heroes. How is he doing?
He's doing great. He
do you know him personally?
Yes, of course.
Very good.
I was able to drive his car.
There's a picture here of his car here.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And I was able to drive the Williams in Buenos Aires this year. No, last year. And I call him. And I say, Carlos, I'm glad you didn't been able to go to the racetrack because I have the pleasure to drive your car. And he was laughing. He was driving his car at the time on the road. And I called him on the phone. And actually, he was involved in politics.
I know, Governor of Santa Fe, right?
Right, and he was excellent. And has a very good chance to run for president, and finally he didn't accept it. He's a very honest person and a very hard worker.
The first part is your big problem in politics. If you're honest in politics, you won't get it.
Yes, yeah, you're right. I mean, it's maybe that was his problem, and so right now he's still involved. But I think he's like a senator or something like that, I don't remember.
How far is Santa Fe from Balcarce?
It's about 500 kilometers.
Yeah. You know, I have very fond memories of Carlos Reutemann. I remember when he won his first race, Formula One race, in South Africa.
Yes.
I remember listening to his interview on BBC World Service. You know, he won the 1978 British Grand Prix for Ferrari when he passed Lauda in the closing stages. That's a great, great win. And I, you know, one thing I felt always sorry for him is that he won in Brazil 3 times, but he never won in Argentina, which was very sad.
Very sad, and he was leading in Argentina several times. One of the races is, I think, the picture is right here. He was with Brabham.
Yeah, 73, I believe.
I think so. Yeah. And he was leading the race, and something happened with the... Something happened with the car. He ran out of gasoline.
Yeah.
Maybe two laps to go, some say that.
Yeah. And great guy. You know, I would love to come to Argentina someday and meet him and meet you also.
Yes. Well, definitely. He's a guy that actually, there is a book that I don't know how much involvement it was from him in this book. But I would like to read it because I think he was running in one of the best era of the Formula One races.
Yeah. You know, him, Carlos Reutemann, Carlos Porsche, both drove for Brabham. Yes. And then he had a tremendous career, you know. He went to Ferrari, he went to Williams. And who else did he drive for? Lotus. He was a teammate with Andretti. Yeah, so very successful career. And I remember in the early 70s when I would, you know, look at Road and Track and other racing magazines, he had one more positive thing. They would show up, you know, have pictures of wives of Formula One drivers. Mimica was the best looking Grand Prix driver's wife.
Oh, yes, 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 wife? Yes, definitely. Mimica, yes, definitely. And actually, I think she is now living in Europe.
Wow.
So he came back to Argentina, she stayed in Europe.
And I heard that his daughter, I believe Cora, was involved in racing, like with some painting or something was doing with racing.
Yeah.
One of his daughters, Cora.
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
it's possible, but I didn't know that.
Interesting.
Yes.
So we thank you very much. It's very nice to see you again. And do you come back to America every now and then?
Yes, I do. I do. This is like home for me because...
Oh, very good. America is home for everybody.
I know. Yeah. It's truth.
Me too.
It's fantastic. And I have wonderful memories. I have wonderful friends. It's definitely home. So every time I have the chance to come back, I do it.
If I come to Argentina next year, how do I get in touch with you?
I give you all the information.
Yeah,
yes.
I would love to come meet you and Carlos Reutemann. One of the things in my life I want to do is go to your uncle's museum.
Okay, yeah. I live at about 15 minutes from there.
And to go there with you, it will be an incredible feeling.
We'll do that together.
And we have a small present for you that we did.
All right.
Okay. Thank you so much. Let me get you your...
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Juan, for that great interview. We'll be back in 60 seconds.
And here's your F1Weekly.com trivia answer. Jacques Lafitte was the most numerous winner for Ligier, scoring 6 victories. André de Cesaris was a pilot for the team in 84 and 85. Olivier Panis started with Ligier in 94 and then followed with Prost, VAR, and Toyota. Aguri Suzuki ended his career getting one of his 8 points for Ligier in 95, but Derek Warwick ran for Tolman, Renault, Brabham, Arrows, Lotus, and Footwork, but never Ligier. So there's your answer, Derek Warwick.